Luke Broyles, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Thank you, Jordan. Happy to be here, and it's very nice we're doing this in person. That's a rare treat, so it's great.
This is our second time meeting in person, right? I think we met.
We met in Miami. You know, we hung out those 2-3 days or whatever, but we are in Colorado right now in Telluride for a Bitcoin-related event, and this has been really fun. This is a whole nother level.
So maybe we can talk about that in a little bit, but for maybe people who aren't familiar with you or your work, kind of, why don't you give an intro to who Luke Broyles is?
Yeah, so I'm pretty young. I had many hobbies when I was a child, and the one that really stuck was filmmaking. I loved filmmaking. I made lots of movies, first, second, third grade, 6, 7, 8 years old. I was making huge projects for someone that age, and I was very happy with them, lots of premieres, film festivals, awards, audience choice awards, lots of traveling. I traveled a lot when I was young teenage years to film festivals, and I met a lot of filmmakers. many filmmakers, both whose names people would probably recognize, but as well as films they'd recognize. And, I saw that industry and I really loved it, really enjoyed it. What I loved about it was telling stories that were either explicitly Christian stories or gospel stories, or stories I thought at the very least were aiding in truth to society. So stories that focused on family, stories that focused on the preciousness of time, stories that focused on the importance of objectivity and the importance of, morality. So I really focused on that for a long time. And then end of high school and early college years, I was transitioning more into finance. I still love storytelling to this day, but the reality was I was realizing even back then, early 20s, late teens, was that I saw the film industry change so much. I remember when I first started, even though we're talking like an 8-year-old self, I remember clearly the debate of would digital cameras replace film cameras. Mm-hmm. I remember clearly the debate of CGI, and now here we are 15 years later. And even our own setup here, it's just this very setup we have here, both audio and the video recording, it was unimaginable when I first started, and I've seen so many iterations there. So anyway, long story short, is I realized that the stories I want to make, the films I want to make, would be very difficult to do profitably. And so I made the choice, do I want to keep making these films, force myself to somehow be profitable, or transition to a different industry that I could enjoy just as much? And for me, that was real estate. I started there. Enjoyed that. And now recently, I've transitioned to different financial topics, Bitcoin related, which we'll get to more later, I'm sure. But
maybe let's just back up just a little bit. Where did the interest in film happen?
I just tried so many things when I was little. I did cooking. I did karate. I did swimming. I did lots of creative things. I wrote books. I did photography and lots of different things. But film was the one that stuck. And I think it stuck because it was so multifaceted and so such a low time preference too. Each film project took a year.
Yeah.
And I frankly know very little 9-year-olds that are thinking out a year and a half of a project that they're working. I was weird. Yeah. I was really weird. I was working multiple projects at once, of course most of my peers, frankly are only thinking much shorter time preference. So for whatever reason, between my parents upbringing me, I'm sure between my genetics, I'm sure between just the way God wired me, I just always had that long time preference, and a film project was something that fit that really well.
Did your parents have film background?
No, absolutely not. No, my dad's a pastor and my mother was a graphic designer. So.
Okay.
yeah, nothing at all. Nothing. Okay. Nothing at all. Even less so finance related. So.
Okay. So dad's a pastor. So he's growing up, was he always been a pastor as long as you can remember?
Basically, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But brief periods were not, but essentially, yes.
Okay. And so how was that for you growing up as a pastor's kid? That can be, great in some cases, horrible in many other cases. What was that?
Yeah, I don't really know why people say that. I mean, I didn't really hear the term pastor's kid or PK or anything until a few years ago in my late teens. Okay. I had a really good childhood. I loved being a part of the church. I loved seeing behind the scenes of the church. I loved, meeting people. It was great. Yeah, no complaints.
Yeah.
There.
Mm-hmm. Good.
No. Yeah, there's no place there.
So obviously your parents had a faith that was, real and vibrant and important to them. where does your kind of story intersect with that?
Yeah, they were believers, you know, as far as I can remember, and likewise I was too. You know, I was, you know, a believer since youth. You know, as a kid, I have differences to my parents theologically. Some more pronounced than others. I think it could be debatable whether you know the significance of those. But you know, my faith has become my own, and I think that's something a lot of people miss, is that they think, oh, just because you have a certain belief system, you know, Christians, atheists, you know, Muslim, whatever your worldview is, just because your parents said that too, it means it's the exact same. No, for me, it's different. But you know, I love my parents. I had a good upbringing, and I think, obviously, besides them teaching me morality, right and wrong, Christian, you know, worldview, I think something they also did especially good as parents was that they helped me think about the world outside of the U.S. I think it's something they did really well. And obviously you can do that when you're older too, but for me, I think that was really important. Looking back, I see how perfectly that changed my life. It's just a tiny thing they did when I was young, but I think that's something that's really compounded over the years to influence who I am today.
In what capacity did they do that? Was it strictly or primarily religious? You know,
No. Well, my dad was a missions pastor for a while when I was young. Okay. So he was often overseas or outside of the country. So that was something that was a regular occurrence that was talked about, like, oh, he's over here serving these people with this or over there with that. So that wasn't part of it. Another part of it was my mom would, you know, read me books or we'd look at pictures. You know, like, really, I enjoyed, and partly it's because I think I have an analytical mind. So I think it was a combination of those things that they, that the topic continued to come up, and I had an analytical mind, and just realizing, you know, how many people don't have the same luxuries we do here in the States. And I know there are lots of kids that have exposure to that, but I think the vast majority don't. And for me, I'm very fortunate that between my personality and between my parents, I think that really come out of there. But yeah, books, talking about it. We would always pray and think about that. And it's as cliche as it is, just being intentional about that, really, especially on a young person's mind.
And so
rewires the brain.
Would you attribute some of that into your interest in film?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, one of my documentaries, it wasn't the documentary that got the most awards, but one of the documentaries I did was a documentary went to Mali, Africa, which is a country in northwestern Africa, in the Horn of Africa. Most people don't know where it is. It's near Algeria or Niger. You know, if you look it up on a map, it's a really big country, you know, much larger than our states here in the U.S. But I did a documentary there. We went on there for 11 days. I met the first lady of the country. I did lots of video work there. It was really good experience, especially as like a 12 or 13 year old. Really, you know, really eye-opening, really amazing, you know, until you see it in person. It's never quite the same.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was definitely part of it. I did other documentaries that were about the subject, but anyway.
Yeah. And so you have this faith background, it's manifesting itself through film in some capacity. You reach a point where you realize this is going to be a much tougher sell to do this vocationally, to continue to pursue this thing vocationally, film in this respect. So you start looking into other avenues, finance, you know, you've mentioned real estate.
Yeah, sure.
So kind of what form did that take? Was this post high school, and how did you kind of pursue those things, education in those?
Yeah, well, I started pursuing film in my education. I did many years of film school. Frankly, I was quite good at it, especially for my age. But then I transitioned to finance education, and so I just transitioned to schooling, and then I didn't complete my degree just because I had better opportunities elsewhere, frankly. So so about that age range, late high school, early college.
And so what did that educational, was that, I mean, you said in some way self-guided, you're trying to understand, but like real estate, how did you have mentors?
Oh yeah. Or? Yeah. No. I had formal training both in film and finance, but frankly, the vast majority of things I learned both in film and finance have been self-taught, mentors learning from other individuals that are farther ahead of me. I mean, like, I have nothing against the school system, but it was not nearly as informative or influential in my worldview as people that I've met and people I've admired have been for me.
Okay.
So mentors.
And so what drew you to finance? I mean, that's for many people, that that would seem to be a drastically different change from the arts to numbers. So what do you attribute
sure, you can make that case, but really, to me, what is filmmaking? Filmmaking's a people business. It's like, mm-hmm. it's all about who you know, who you can get on a set, who your editor's going to be. Mm-hmm. Going to film festivals, it's a people business. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with finance. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, who are your investors, who are you partnering with, who are your customers? It's like, so yeah, it's very different in the application of it, but I mean, you know, keep my filmmaking, I was doing all my own budgeting. Yeah. Like, dude, all my own budgeting, all the logistics for the film days, you know, I mean, there's a lot of logistics and math that goes into making a film.
Sure.
You know, a significant portion of all the work that goes into that. And so, I mean, you know, if you could be creative in finance industry, I mean, really, I don't feel that much of a difference. I know sure. it seems like that to most people,
yeah.
but like, I love what I do now just as much as I did then. And sure, it manifests in many different ways, but to me, engaging my brain and creating fulfilling relationships with people, including you. You know, it's true no matter the industry you're in.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is obviously the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. So we've gone probably 15 minutes without talking about Bitcoin.
Yeah. What's wrong?
What was the transition to taking an interest in Bitcoin?
Yeah. So that's, So first I started learning about finance, you know, general finance, personal finance. Debt, budgeting, all that. Of course, then you get into the stock market once you learn about, you know, okay, what's a 401k, IRA, all that, you know, that, it's very easy transition. So learn about the stocks. Then that's an easy transition in real estate because, okay, you know, you have your budgeting. Where's your budgeting come from? It comes from your W-2, you know, income, 401ks, stocks, and then real estate was a topic I learned a lot about, became obsessed with it for a while, and still am to a certain degree. but it really quickly became clear to me, wait a second, real estate is a significantly better investment than stocks for the sole reason you can borrow money against the real estate at really low interest rates. You know, if you buy $1,000 of stocks, let's say a larger number, let's say $100,000 of stocks. You know, if in 20 years it goes up 10x to $1 million, that's great. But with real estate, with $100,000, you could borrow an absurd amount of money from the bank, an absurdly low interest rate. And, you know, let's say you have 4% interest rate. Obviously, they're not right now, but again, this is a few years ago when I'm referring to 3 or 4 years ago now. You know, it just became clear to me that real estate people have this massive advantage because money is printed from the government, and that makes the mortgage very valuable. Like I often say now, even more so now, that the value of real estate is not the real estate. The value of real estate is the mortgage. It's the debt, you know, because you are buying hard assets with another asset you essentially can create out of thin air, you know, be it borrowing money, you know. And for me, it really clicked because that's backwards. That doesn't make sense. I know, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this, you know Dave Ramsey, you know, and or even not Dave Ramsey, you know, anti-debt, but it's like, okay, let's go even deeper. Like the Bible makes it very clear that the borrower is slave to the lender. So why is it that these borrowers, these real estate borrowers, are benefiting disproportionately more than literally everyone else?
Yeah.
And so it became clear to me, wait a second, the Bible says that the borrower is slave to the lender. The Bible says that debt is something to be avoided. And yet, in the way the world is now, debtors are incentivized to take on more debt.
Yeah.
So then you think about that. Okay, why is that the case? Well, it's because the U.S. government is the largest debtor in the world.
Mm.
You know, all the governments around the world are debtors in the world. And so when you have the U.S. government, and this is not a rant against the U.S. government. I'll get to that more in a second. But the problem is that the U.S. government is run by human beings. It's run by people. Mm-hmm. And they have this ability to create new units, new dollars, new what I often call political currency units, because that's what they are.
Yep.
That's the more accurate term. They have the ability to do that. And so since they have the debt, they will use that ability they have to distort reality in that sense as long as they possibly can, which is why people that buy stocks, people that buy real estate, gold, bonds, any asset in the world, make money. You know, they make money. The stock market goes up, real estate goes up, all these things go up because we distort.
They go up denominated in the dollar.
Yeah, yeah. They go up because we have to. You know, if, like, let's say real estate. You know, right now, obviously jumping forward today, rates are much higher than 4%. And, you know, they may go up or down in the future, who knows? But what happens if real estate starts to go down? Well, all these real estate people that have borrowed for decades, they all become underwater. Like dwarfs the great financial crisis, dwarfs 2008. You know, same thing with the U.S. government. If the value of the debt in relation to our productivity goes up, the U.S. government is broke. U.S. government's broke. All stocks and all companies are broke. All real estate investors are broke. And so then it becomes obvious, okay, that's when it clicked for me. If you give the humans the ability to print more money, to create new currency units via policy, via politics, or whatever means they have, if you give humans the ability to create more politics, they will 100% inevitably guaranteed do so, because the pain of prices coming down is too great that they have to do that. And so then, viewing that from the biblical worldview, it's like, oh, of course, all humans are sinful, all humans fall short of the glory of God. And if you have money, which is the foundational economic layer of the entire planet, dependent on one person or one board of people that have the ability to create more money, then it should be self-evident. It should be obvious. I think it is to a lot of people, but I don't think they realize the true extent of that. You know, we attribute many problems we face today to politics, like, oh, I can't believe X president or Y senator or this, you know, whatever. You know, we tend to assign the problem at these politics, where I would come in with this perspective that the underlying problem beneath that is the money. Which to me, I don't think most people think that. I think they think the money flows from politics. And I would argue the politics flows from the money. Everything in the world just comes down to money. That's just the truth. And so Bitcoin comes in. I'm like, okay, this is real quick,
how did you hear about Bitcoin?
I first heard of it, I don't remember the first time I've heard it. I really wish I could remember when. I don't. But I don't remember when the first time was. I think the first time I really heard about it was 2017. I thought it was dumb, you know, like most people. I thought it was like, I'm not going to look into this. Like, worst case scenario, it's a Ponzi scheme and a scam. Best case scenario, it's some speculation. I want more safe assets. You know, I want my bonds.
Serious investment.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm young now, but you know, then I was 18, 19 years old, and I don't say this to be arrogant, but it's true. Like, I was a long-term thinker. You know, most 18-year-olds are not thinking about real estate 30 years out. Most, you know, 8-year-olds are not thinking about a movie project 2 years out. And so I was a long-term thinker, and it's like, I don't want to mess with this Bitcoin stuff because I want to start saving money in my stocks, my Roth, you know, my Roth IRA. You know, so I just ignored it completely. 2017, ignored it. 2018, ignored it, you know, because I thought, you know, it's just not worth it. Even the best case scenario is a speculation, so it's not worth it to me. Then 2019 comes around. I have a friend that I met during my college years, and he was very smart. He had certain positions in the government that were very high, and I thought he was brilliant. There are very few people I know that I would call a genius, and he was probably one of them. And he had a lot of Bitcoin. He was first buying it, mining it, like way early days, Bitcoin. And I was like, wait a second. This person I know, I think he's intelligent, and he has the vast majority of his net worth in Bitcoin. I'm wrong here. Either my assessment of him as intelligent is wrong, or I've made a miscalculation about Bitcoin. And that was an aha moment for me. Having that humility, and I know it's arrogant to say, like, oh, look, I was humble. But no, it's in this instance, it was really the case. I realized very quickly, I'm wrong about something here. I'm either wrong about assessing this person, or I'm wrong about Bitcoin. I was very sure about both. And so I started learning more about Bitcoin. I was like, okay, maybe he's onto something, whatever. So I just started learning about it. I watched maybe a few documentaries about it, read about it more. I still was having trouble understanding it. You know, I knew about the halvings. I knew about the basics of Bitcoin. But then it wasn't until 2020 happened, where I think, you know, most people, their lives changed in 2020. But for me in 2020, I realized the bond market's broken. I could feel it. I could see it. I'm also a history nerd. I love history. It's like, okay, this was really bad. When the world was freaking out about variants and the lockdowns, obviously that was a major concern of mine too. But again, being a long-term thinker, I was like, oh my goodness, we just destroyed our bond market. And the world runs on the bond market. All money, all currencies, you know, the U.S., the rest of the world, basically everything is a derivative of the 10-year treasury bond. Everything is a derivative of the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar it survives inherently dependent on the bond market. And I realized, wait a second, we've been lowering interest rates for 40 years in bonds. Sorry, I'm kind of going on a rant, but you know, in 2020, that's when demand started getting sucked out from bonds. That's when interest rates reversed their 45-year course out of bonds. And this wasn't just some, 20-year-old kid making this up. Like, very prominent people that looked at history beyond the last 50 years, yeah, which is heavily biased towards U.S.
Sure.
dominance.
Sure.
I began to realize this is a really big problem. And
just real quick, can you, because again, there's people listening to this with no idea. Yeah, like, they've heard about bonds. So like, can you just explain me in like a nutshell, like what is a bond?
Well,
how do they work? How does the bond market
work? Well, again, let's go back to the basics here. Money runs everything. Money runs the world. Mm. All economics, all policies, all laws, all regulations, everything comes down to money. Even the U.S. Constitution, what is that? It's a piece of paper and that defends people's property rights. Mm. So it's like even that is a derivative of who controls the money, who owns the money, who has rights to money. Life, the pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, property, like all that comes down to, like, I would argue there's a Christian case for this too, a spiritual case. Jesus says the love of money, or the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. And so I think
you can't serve God and money. It's a choice.
Exactly. Yeah. So really everything of our age here, everything of our lifetime on earth can be denominated money. Money is the way at which we communicate value to each other, economic, moral, otherwise. All incentives are a derivative or dependent on the incentives of money. Yeah. And how does a government, let's say the United States here, defend that money? It's via the bonds or ability to raise new capital from people. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's also dependent on their ability to tax the population and everything else, but it all comes down to the bonds. If the government cannot raise money and spend money, they can't get politicians elected, because how are they going to be able to do that? So how
does a bond help the government raise money?
Well, a bond is a debt contract for the government. The government issues a bond.
Sure.
People pay money, aka they give their energy to the government. I say I like the government and I want their debt. I give the government my energy. Yeah. In exchange, I get the piece of paper that's called a bond. And so if...
That promises to...
Exactly.
Repay you... With interest at a later date.
Yeah, basically. Exactly. And so that's the problem. If there's no demand for bonds, the government can't acquire any energy because no one's willing to give them energy. I'm not willing to sell my real estate or my gold or give my productivity to the government in exchange for that bond. And so
if the bond market is broken, you're saying, so if the bond market is broken, then no one's going to invest their money, store of energy in it.
Yeah.
So then what happens?
Well, and I don't want to get too dramatic here, but this is, again, when you look at history and you look at it from a financial lens, this is a major red flag for conflict. Mm. Look at the American Revolution. Look at the French Revolution, World War One, World War Two, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, or both Chinese revolutions. Just look at, and that's just in the last century and a half or so. You look back over millennia, like so many conflicts arise as a result of this. As a result of what I call this monetary cannibalism, essentially. Mm-hmm. If the government can't raise debt, the government can't raise money, what happens? Government gets more desperate. Mm. When they get more desperate, people trust the government less. When they trust the government less, they're less willing to buy bonds. They're less willing to buy bonds, the government gets more desperate. And it just continues. It's a negative feedback loop. That's the problem. In the same way that you can think of a credit card addict, and I've met people that have, it's really sad, but that's what happens. They borrow, and now their income, their productivity can't keep up with their interest payments. They can't keep up with their debt. And so even a modest amount of credit card debt just spirals out of control.
Yeah, at 25% or 19% or whatever.
Well, even at low interest rates, the math still doesn't work. At higher interest rates, the math doesn't work either way. It's just that the higher interest rate, the faster it occurs.
Yeah.
And that, in a very oversimplified way, was the concern I came to in 2020. I'm like, wait a second, we just shut down the world for months on end.
We've productive just, capacity of the world.
Yeah. Which, and obviously as massive humanitarian issues, which I was furious about, we were, here in the States, we're privileged enough that, we just have delays in our movies and our new phone releases, but elsewhere around the world, they have much more serious issues when we shut down the world. But then I realized, okay, we have probably crossed a tipping point. And I do think that. I do think when people look back, they'll remember 2020 as one of, if not the critical years at which demand started declining for bonds. So anyway, I know we've gotten really distracted here, but...
So 2019, I realized, or 2020, bond market is broken. And then...
Because...
How does that affect your view of Bitcoin? Like, where did that... I mean, obviously you talked about it a little bit.
Well, here's the problem. In 2020, people were saying, oh, deflation is going to be a problem. We don't have to worry about inflation because demand's going to do it. And I was like, no, I know that's wrong. Like Nobel Prize economists, you know, every politician, every side of the aisle, Treasury, Fed, everyone said that price is going to come down. Everything's going to collapse. We have to print a bunch of money to bail everyone out. And I was like, no, that's wrong. Because when the government can't repay their bonds, they have to print money to make up the deficit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, again, let's take the credit card person for simplicity. If you can't pay your credit card bills and you no longer have the income or productivity to do that, and I give you a magical red button that you could just print to compensate the difference, you will do it every single time.
Yeah.
Because you will do everything you can to meet this month's credit card bill so you can feed your kids.
Yeah.
And that's what we did here. And that's when I realized, okay, we just broke that. We're not bringing enough productivity anymore.
Sure.
And so now I'm like, okay, real estate's about to skyrocket. Stock's about to skyrocket. There's going to be so much inflation.
Anything that can't be created as quickly as the dollars.
Yes.
Exactly. The currency itself is going to go up and denominated in the currency.
Anything that can't be created out of thin air will go up in price in terms of things that can be created out of thin air.
Yeah.
Indefinitely, forever.
Yeah.
So I realized, okay, this is a problem. We've just escalated this. What's the solution? I was like, I don't know the solution. I guess real estate, because real estate, you can borrow debt. And like I said before, you know, the more they print, the more it benefits real estate investors. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm good with my real estate. So I was like, okay. But then 2021, I realized that's not a fix. That's just delaying it. And so then the humanitarian case for Bitcoin, I came across and I realized, in hindsight, it was so obvious, but I wonder why it took me so long to get there. But I came to Bitcoin viewing it as a solution or the solution to this problem.
How did you even start learning about it? Kind of where did you go? What did you read
just,
or listen to?
YouTube videos, articles, reading lots of nerdy tech stuff that people don't, you know, care about.
Yeah.
But really what tipped me over the edge was realizing the humanitarian impact. Because everything I'm saying, you know, many people might be glossing over it, but everything I'm saying has a human cost.
Yeah.
You know, this whole, you know, bond market, blah, 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 real estate, blah, blah, blah. It's like, this is real. This is real for people. Yeah. You know, I can sit here and talk about mortgages and interest rates all day, but it's like, at the end of the day, we're talking about people's ability to afford housing in the US and elsewhere. You know, I can blabber on about bond markets all day, but it's like, at the end of the day, this is a major predictor of conflict. So it's like, these are major things. And so I realized, okay, the only way, let me put it this way. The ability for humans to print money is a flaw in our technology.
Mm.
Political currency, what's the flaw? Is the ability, it's that we can create more currency. That's the flaw.
Yep.
And so, okay, that's a technological problem. Either we have to solve that technological problem or humans become moral and without sin.
Yeah, we have to solve people.
Like,
yeah.
Okay, I know one of those can't work. Only Jesus can do that.
Yeah.
So the only solution to that problem then is finding a technological solution to that problem. And the only thing that can do that is finding a form of money that cannot be changed by human beings.
Yeah.
That's a solution.
Change, or when you say change, you mean
you can't produce
more of it. Yes.
You can't print or destroy any of it.
Yeah.
It has to be a fixed number. That's the only way that you can take humans out of the loop. A fixed number that cannot be changed later.
Now, there's a lot of people listening to this for whom that sounds insane, because they're like, hey, Bitcoin is just this digital currency.
Yeah.
Like, why can't someone just keystroke more of it? You know, like, what?
Yeah.
And so what would be your answer to those kind of people?
Well, that's a very good question. I thought the same thing. It's like, okay, Bitcoin's cool, but there'll be innovations, new Bitcoins.
Sure.
I could just copy Bitcoin.
Sure.
But the computer was invented in 1948, right? And the beauty of the computer is that we could duplicate information indefinitely. You know, right now we're recording this podcast. Someone watching this could download it, duplicate it 10,000 times, upload it on 10,000 different podcasts. You know, all information up to this point, computing-wise, we have been able to replicate.
Mm.
And so that's what we intuitively think all digital things have to be.
Sure.
My position, the way I would put this, is that Bitcoin is essentially an algorithm that is reinforcing its own scarcity. It is fundamentally, first and foremost, not a financial thing. It's first and foremost not money. Mm. What it is it's a self-defense network. It's basically like this giant immune system. Mm. The reason why it's good money, the reason why people should consider allocated. All that is downstream
from what
of the first principles. And the first principle is, this is a computer network that, like other computer networks, defends itself. And what this thing happens to be defending is not some, you know, piece of information by some paywall or some, you know, private security. What it's defending is a line of code, an equation that's a fixed number. That's essentially what it is. It is designed, and this is where we get technical, where we're not going to go as here. But the long story short is that, unlike to what we consider most digital information, this is information that's open source. It's public. Anyone can copy Bitcoin, and people have copied Bitcoin numerous times.
Yeah.
But the difference is that, as far as defending that equation and defending that equation's value, really there is no second best, as others would say, that Bitcoin is the most secure compared to everything else by millions of times, hundreds of thousands to millions of times easily. It is far more secure in that sense, and far more, therefore, difficult to reproduce. Okay. You know, Bitcoin's been around for 15 years. I mean, it's hard because this is very technical, but let me just put it this way anecdotally. Bitcoin's been around for 15 years. Right now, it's worth $500 billion. It was $1 trillion or more. And it's open source code. It's 30,000 lines of code. Mm-hmm. Okay. Me sitting here, I've looked at the tag. You've looked at it too. It's like, if I could duplicate this, I would. Like, if $500 billion for 15 years sitting out there, open source, not a single person. It would require collaboration from me to Putin to every government official. Like, it's out there.
So real quick.
Potentially
confusion.
Sorry.
So no, the potential confusion of, you said it's been copied, but it can't be copied.
Well,
so what do you?
The code can be copied. The value cannot be copied. So let's say a game of chess. This metaphor has been given many times before. The rules of a game of chess are open source. Anyone can look at a game of chess and be like, okay, the rook moves this way, the queen moves that way, and the king moves this way. You win this way, you lose in that way.
Mm.
The rules of chess are open source. You can copy the rules of chess. I can make Luke chess. And, you know, okay, the rook doesn't go horizontally. It also goes diagonally like the bishop. You know, I can make my own rules. And, okay, I can do that infinite number of times, but...
You can't convince people to necessarily play Luke chess.
I can't convince people to play my version of chess. It's the first version of chess people want because it's the set of rules that works the best and is the most fair to them. And it's the same way with Bitcoin. People have copied Bitcoin numerous times. And they've, you know, done so for a variety of reasons. But these are all different forms of chess. So yes, they're copying it in the same way they're copying the rules and tweaking it slightly to their own advantage.
Sure.
But
then they have to find an audience to participate and play their game by their rules.
Precisely. Yeah. And because they have alternated the rules, because they've put it inside chip control and distorted it to their benefit at the direct expense of everyone involved, at the direct expense of all the users, that inherently makes it inferior. Yeah. So every copy is inherently inferior. So you can think of Bitcoin as this line of code, this algorithm that's designed to not confiscate, destroy, or manipulate the wealth of any user. And so inherently, any copy of it, any dilution of that, any change to now benefits when you show it, it's like, okay, it's completely worthless. You know, it, and like, sure, it might, you can pretend like it has some value, but long term, like, it will be viewed as worthless because it's like your fake version of chess is going to be worthless. Or let's take another example of the internet. You know, the internet, and this is perhaps even a better example, the internet in the 80s and 90s, there were many internets, and most people don't realize that today, but there were many internets. There were some internets that were centralized, and that's most of them actually.
Yeah.
And then there were some that were not. The one people are listening to this on right now is the one that was not.
Yeah.
So you can duplicate the internet as many times as you want.
Yeah.
But the internet protocol, TCP/IP, that does not manipulate the information of its users is the one that wins. Like, you, like, if you're listening to this, you've literally only used one internet in your life, even though there you could have thousands of internets.
A network is only as valuable as the sum of its participants, right?
Precisely.
If no one is using a network, then it's not valuable.
Yeah. So you could copy Bitcoin as many times as you want. You could copy it 100 trillion times for all I care. You could copy the internet 100 trillion times for all I care. You could copy chess 100 billion times. Yeah. But the set of rules that is best suited is the one that will be dominant against everything else. So again, Bitcoin is this kind of immune system that defends itself against human intervention within itself. And because it does that so well, it inherently prevents against attacks elsewhere of duplications.
And so Okay. So how does that happen though? Like how does Bitcoin both attract participants and defend itself against large state actors who are, you know, this is one of the people, questions of people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why, you know, can the US government stop it? Can China stop it? Like what about the way that Bitcoin works allows it to, you know, attract people,
yeah,
and protect itself against, yeah, bad actors?
Well, I'll simplify it, but first let's sympathize something people might understand better. Let's simplify the US government. I could sit here and explain to you how the treasury market works, or how the Fed works, or how Congress works, or how, you know, election cycle. You know, I could explain those technicals. Really, you don't need to know that. You know, what you need to know fundamentally is that they can create money.
Yeah.
And so the incentive is, have your team have just enough influence over the other team that you get the seat of power where you can control the money prior limit.
Your interests.
Yes. Yeah. But at the same time, you don't want to have too much power, because if you have too much power and the competing party doesn't have enough power, then you have sole control to where your money printer is always on and nobody trusts the currency anymore.
Sure, sure.
And so what you need are two groups that have roughly the same amount of power that are constantly competing over that lever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you could look at that.
Over that what?
The lever.
Okay.
The lever for money printing, the button,
sure,
for money printing. And look at history. You know, look at Germany in the 1930s. You had the communists and you had the fascists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at Britain and their internal conflicts. Look at, you know, the United States and the American Revolution. All this political power trends towards two competing factions over the ability to create money and therefore also create the laws and the policies, the rules and regulations,
sure,
of the society. And so the reason that's so predictable is because that's just game theory and incentives.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say that first to emphasize that. Transitioning it over to Bitcoin, I'm not going to explain the mechanics of Bitcoin,
yeah,
right now in the same way I would not explain to you, you know, how, you know, Congress, recess, all that works. You know, you just have to understand the concept. And because of that reason, then those political currencies decline in value over time.
So basically, Bitcoin is a currency that can't be created out of thin air. Why can't it be created?
Exactly. So I just described the U.S. government, which then applies to all governments.
Yeah.
With Bitcoin, the difference is that you inherently cannot operate within Bitcoin unless you agree to that certain set of rules. So like with the game of chess, you inherently cannot play that game of chess unless you metaphorically sign this contract saying, I will follow all these rules, and if I don't, I will be kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it is with Bitcoin. You inherently cannot spend Bitcoin, buy Bitcoin, hold Bitcoin. You inherently can't do that,
yeah,
unless you are directly, voluntarily saying, I will agree to the given rules,
yeah,
of this system. And as soon as anyone does that, they are
lending credibility to Bitcoin.
Well, they're kicked out of the network.
Oh, if they don't play by.
So like for me, example, you know, people hear about Bitcoin mining, people hear about forks and hard forks and all, you know, and perhaps they haven't, but essentially what that is that if I'm aiding Bitcoin's strength and success and stability, I get compensated in Bitcoin. I get compensated in this thing I find valuable. And if I then interject, say, actually, I want to change it a little bit, now all of a sudden, I don't get compensated.
Mm.
And so in the same way that political currency incentivizes people to have more and more political power and centralize that chair, that armchair of money printing further and further indefinitely until all trust is lost, in contrast with Bitcoin, you only get to operate within Bitcoin if you provide energy to it.
Yes.
And if you follow those rules. And if you follow those rules where you start to try to exploit people, then again, the software, line of code, it kicks you out,
yeah,
of it, and you can no longer do it. Now you have your own Bitcoin, but it, again,
it's your network,
it's inferior. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, to give a practical example, this is a place where most people should go if they really want to dive into the tech here or learn more about this, or the block size wars of 2016, 2017. That some of the people that were very early into Bitcoin's core development basically said, you know, Bitcoin's cool. From 2010 to 2016 or whatever, you know, it's worked just fine, but we got to change it. We got to make it more advantageous. We got to improve it. That was the argument. In reality, they wanted to improve it to their own benefit.
Yeah.
And so in 2016, 2017, these block size wars, that some of these core people tried to encourage the network, encourage everyone to just go along with them to benefit them, to where they essentially could be the new politicians.
True.
And they were obliterated to an embarrassing level. And again, these are people that were like core of Bitcoin's early
development. These very powerful, like they were heads
extremely
of
powerful.
Very powerful corporations stuff, companies.
And so even Bitcoin's own core developer, even those humans showed themselves that they were fallible, number one, which goes into the Christian ethos. Mm-hmm. But then number two, they failed and like failed miserably.
Yeah.
And then third, Bitcoin got stronger in the face of that. Mm. So you mentioned China and the U.S. China could try to ban it. Yeah. And they have five times. And all five times they failed.
Yeah.
And they failed so bad that Bitcoin got stronger.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible to fail against, you know, let's say two nations go to war. It's possible to fail the war and you also still weaken your opponent.
Sure.
No. It's the opposite here. It's like, imagine China going to war with another country, and in them attacking the other country, the country got three times stronger.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is the difference here with Bitcoin compared to these other kinds of conflicts, is that as you try to censor, as you try to, you throw energy at it, trying to destroy it, it just takes in that energy. You give it via electricity or monetary energy or whatever.
So it's literally the principle of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Is what you're describing.
Yeah, pretty much. I know that sounds woo-woo, like energy, but I'm talking about, number one, electricity. Number two, capital. So monetary energy, money. Yeah. The number three, intellectual capital and, spreading awareness of it. In all those instances, they failed every single time. The Taliban has failed. Vladimir Putin has failed. The CIA has failed. Mm-hmm. Every major institution failed. Banks hate it. Like, everyone in power that has any access to their own money printer hates Bitcoin. Politicians hate it. They've made it very clear they hate it. Banks hate it. A lot of people hate it. And all the people that make those duplicate Bitcoins hate Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You know, again, those core developers in 2017, when they duplicated it, what was their biggest assumption now? Kill Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And again, they failed. They destroyed themselves and they made Bitcoin stronger.
They wanted to kill it by creating an alternative and trying to convince people to use that.
You
want to incentivize people to.
Yeah,
to
you don't want demand for Bitcoin because you want demand for your Bitcoin.
Your coin,
So anyway, I'm glossing over a lot, but. And people. It's really hard to explain the technicals. I want to emphasize that. Like, if you have trouble, you're not dumb.
Yeah.
it's just that in the same way, it would take you 3 or 4 years to learn about how the U.S. government technically works or how the banking system technically works. It's no different here.
Sure.
But what you need to understand is the incentive structure. Yeah. And once you understand that, you get the basic gist. Political currency is designed to cannibalize its own value over time. And we can see that firsthand, both from history, the hundreds of examples, but also anecdotally, you can feel it. Compare that to Bitcoin, and it's the polar opposite. In fiat, you are in political currency, you are rewarded for kicking the can down the road. Mm. Or Bitcoin, it's the literal polar opposite. And if you don't agree with that, then you're kicked out because you're a risk to the network.
So you come to this realization. This is what we just talked about is part of your process of seeing.
Wow,
Bitcoin works completely differently.
And it took me 2 years. It took me 2 years.
Okay, yeah.
From early 2021, more like a year and a half. It took me a year and a half. Most people it takes longer, at least 4 or 5 years. But for me, it took a year and a half. Some people like gentleman that you and I both know here, you know, for him it took him weeks, but everyone's different. They have different experience with it, and frankly most people won't learn about this in the same way. Again, you listening on the internet right now, it's like you don't know what the other internets were, you don't know what their company, you don't know why this internet is the best one,
and so
it's just that it is.
So
and
for,
it'll be the same with Bitcoin.
And so for you, like, understanding the nuts and bolts was what helped you see the value in it. There's other people.
I try to kill it in every way. I've spent years of my life now, because again, those 18 months, and now that was years ago. You know, I've spent years trying to figure out how could I kill this thing?
Mm-hmm. Or how could somebody else? And, or whatever.
Like if I had all the money in the world, if I had all the electricity in the world, how could I kill this thing? And I still, to this day, can't think of anything reasonably that could destroy it without destroying the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, the only way to destroy it would be if, you know, you destroy the internet and computers and the grid and all productivity. Mm-hmm. So at that point, then it's just silly to worry about that. So yeah, so I have conviction at first and foremost because I tried to disprove it. And frankly, again, the Christian mindset, some of the biggest proponents of the gospel, some of the best Christian teachers are those that try to disprove the gospel mm-hmm. for years of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like it's the same thing here. I think there's a disconnect. I don't think people realize how obsessed Bitcoiners are with trying to mm-hmm. find an exploit.
Yeah.
Number one, because if they're selfish, then they want to exploit it for themselves.
Yeah.
Like those core developers did. Yeah, sure, I mentioned like they thought they had an exploit and they completely failed.
If they're more selfless, they want to try to find the flaw so they can get out of
it. So they can fix it before someone else.
Fix it or get out of it. If this is a waste of my time, I don't want to waste time in it.
But I mean, you know, think about that. There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, literally the most brilliant coders, technologists, and financial people in the world that could just try to attack this thing. $500 trillion just waiting there to be claimed. And nobody's done it for 15 years.
Sure.
You know, I mean, if there was an exploit for that much money, you can bet in 5 minutes someone would find it. And I've not found it yet. And maybe there is, but I think it's such an absurdly tail risk probability, far end of the bell curve, that I don't even know where to possibly start. Even if you gave me technology 20 years advanced from today, even if you gave me $100 billion, I wouldn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really don't.
So you get into Bitcoin 2 years, you spend the time to learn about it, and then you get to a point where you decide, okay, I want to, so you start thinking about Bitcoin, not just in terms of, again, not just in terms of the nuts and bolts of it, but starting to try to see what are the consequences of both the destruction of the existing monetary system and then the potential of what, of how the incentive structure being reversed and fixed, how that would affect people.
Yeah. So again, I know thus far we've probably been more in the abstract, but it's all real. You know, we could talk about mortgages, interest rates. Again, it's all real. We're talking about real people. We could talk about the lockdowns, but that's real people we're
real
talking
quick,
about.
Real quick, this is the danger, right? Like the danger of all this in the danger, it's purposefully done this way, is to abstract, to create monetary instruments and things that create barriers in between the ability to see what these things are actually doing and representing.
Yeah. So make it as complicated and convoluted as possible. Yes.
So that people have the same thing.
It's the same thing with the tax code. It's the same thing with the US government. It's the same thing with Wall Street.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with the media trying to make Bitcoin more complicated than it really is. Bitcoin is far more simple than Wall Street, the government, and the tax code. But it benefits them to make it more complicated, because if it's more complicated,
then people are willing to pay them money to think for them, right?
Or just that they don't want to invest the time to think, because they're so desperate, frankly, to keep earning money.
So what were some of the, so again, moving beyond the
complicated stuff.
Like what are some of just the practical effects of Bitcoin that impacted you throughout these 2 years?
Well, let's put it this way. Okay, we're Christians. Let's say we go back in time 500 years to the early days of the printing press. And we're sitting here, not in a podcast that you're listening to on the internet at whatever time you want, or whatever, you know, period in future is, but we're, you know, sitting in a local, you know, restaurant, you know, bar, brewery, whatever. And we're having these kinds of conversations. And I tell you, look, right now, 1 out of 16 people can read, and 15 out of 16 people cannot read. And we get all of our information from the Catholic Church and from the King and from the King's approved people and the Catholic Church approved people. Like, what if the information we're being told is not correct? I mean, how would we know? 15 out of 16 of us can't read.
Yeah.
And most of those 1 in 16, you know, they can't read that well.
So,
I mean, books are so scarce. They're changed a lot. They're chained to libraries, and, you know, being able to read itself is a massive privilege of the elite. Like, if us today, looking back at that, we're like, okay, obviously the printing press is a big deal, because the printing press that does multiple things. The first thing it does is that it takes that information and distributes to everyone. So now you have the information. Even if you can't read, you have it.
It enables information to be distributed to everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In a much more efficient, quick way than writing it all out. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So even if I can't read the words, I can look at my piece of paper with the words and your piece of paper, and we can verify, are the letters the same? Even if I don't know the whole context, I can verify. That's the first thing the printing press does. But then the second thing is, because it's so distributed and because it can be verified, then more people are able to read. And so us today here talking on this podcast via the internet, via decentralized, you know, global instant communication protocol of the internet, In our modern world, we look back on that and like, wow, those people were dumb. You know, they were so dumb that they didn't understand why the printing press was a big deal, you know, because they thought, what on earth do I need a printing press for? I can't even read, you know, what's the point? Like, I don't need that. It's just like, I'm like, just let me, you know, do my thing. I don't need it. Like, whatever. And if we from the future try to explain to them, number one, you're being fed false information. Number two, the church / your king are going to become more oppressive as they continue to give you wrong information. And number three, this technology, this printing press thing, is going to make it possible so that you and your kids and your great grandkids and everyone else in your community has the ability to verify this information and read. That is a metaphor I would use for today. Right now, 1 in 16 people in the world, roughly, have property rights. And the other 15 of 16 don't. You know, I mean, you're a missionary, Jordan. Many people listening are probably missionaries. It's like, do people in India?
I was a missionary.
Well, you were, and many of you still are, but you were in developing world.
I get what you're saying.
But it's like, okay, do people in Lebanon have the same property rights I do here, sitting here?
No.
Like, can most people buy, like this whole conversation of real estate versus bonds and stocks, it's like, that's not even a conversation for 6.5 billion people.
Sure.
Yeah. And then for another billion people, it's kind of in the conversation, but it's so expensive, it's not even worth it. Yeah. It's like,
and complicated. And,
people in the developing world cannot get bank accounts because it's not profitable to serve them. The vast majority of the human population do not have financial literacy or property rights in the same way that people 500 years ago did not have literacy. or intellectual property rights, let's say. So it's, in the same way, we are just an ancient of a world in that sense. And so
we're just a what?
We're just in that aspect, we are in an ancient world.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, technologically speaking, sure. Most people can't operate in the modern world.
Sure.
Because they have no money to operate within that modern world. They have no rights. All it takes is a government to take away the title for the house or take away the purchasing power of the currency. And so the humanitarian argument, the reason why this is really important is because the only way to do that is to decentralize and distribute that money, that currency, in the same way that the printing press distributes and decentralizes that information.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are in that world, we have trouble seeing why that's a big deal. Because all we've known for thousands of years is that we can't read. I couldn't read. My parents couldn't read. My grandparents couldn't read. None of us could read. And so it's very difficult to explain why this hunk of metal and wood with movable type is
a game changer.
Is game changing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It completely game changing for you and all of your descendants. And in the same way with Bitcoin, that's the case I would make today, that people have very difficult time understanding it because the common argument is, why on earth do I need Bitcoin when I have dollars?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Why would I need the printing press when I have the king's decree?
Yeah.
You know, and so
why would I need a car when I have a horse and buggy?
Exactly. It's the same thing. That's the case I would make. I think probably this whole political currency dynamic probably is going to lead us to war or series of wars or revolutions or famines or disasters. Because that's simply what the game theory tells me, and that's what hundreds of examples in history tell me. 98% of countries that have surpassed 130% debt to GDP levels resulted in hyperinflation, war, or default within 15 years, and we hit that in 2020. Again, bond market broke in 2020. Yeah. We hit that historical threshold that 98% of political states do not recover from within 15 years, and the other 2% just take longer. My point there is that, you know, even the most optimistic case, you know, let's say the U.S. has far higher probability than the average nation of the past. Like, okay,
to survive, you're saying,
survive. But it's like, okay, those are three options: default, hyperinflation, or war. War is obviously the worst option, but the best case scenario is that we completely default and everything financial gets reset.
Sure.
Like, that's the best case scenario. That's a scenario that I hope for. Not because I'm a pessimist and I want to see things be destroyed, but because the only other alternate is war.
Yeah.
War either externally via multiple nations in armed conflict, or war internally via revolution or turmoil of some sort. So the reason Bitcoin's important is because it reduces the financial incentive to continue that cycle of build, destroy, mm-hmm. from that political stance.
By removing energy from that world.
But by removing right? humans. Yeah. All humans are sinful.
Yes,
all
by humans removing humans short. From the
yeah.
from the process itself.
Yeah, right? The best way to restore morality to a system is remove humans from it. Mm-hmm. That's what the U.S. government is. It's like, okay, kings are corrupt. What's the best thing we can do? Let's remove humans as much as possible from the governmental system. Let's create a constitution. Let's divide power as much as possible. Let's remove humans as much as possible. That's the whole idea of the American government. You know, or take information. What's the idea of the computer? Or,
I don't know if I would agree. Remove humans. It would be more like distribute the power. Well, more, yeah, you know.
Distribute it.
Yeah.
So that humans have the least amount of influence possible. That's my point.
Sure.
You
so
know.
There's accountability, or there's so that there's consequences for their actions.
Yeah.
Rather than
sure.
having a stratified system.
You
where
can make that. But I mean, another example could be the computer or calculators. It's like, you know, if I'm doing, you know, longhand algebra or whatever on a piece of paper, like a calculator is just going to do it better because a human's not involved. I'm not going to unintentionally or intentionally manipulate the math because it just does it for you. And so in the same way with Bitcoin, the hope with that or the promise of that is finding that technological solution or a technological solution that makes it many orders of magnitude more difficult for humans to leverage that tool to harvest wealth from others. And so that's partly at reducing the probability of war, and it's also partly at increasing the probability that we leave this world where the majority of people don't have property rights and transition into a world where more people have property rights. So that's the basic humanitarian case. And I really am convinced that this is the largest humanitarian, that this is the largest secular humanitarian effort of the century. And I think it'll be looked back.
We can debate of whether or not it's actually secular, but you know,
I mean that the gospel is far more important. That's a salvation issue. Bitcoin's not a salvation issue. That's my point there.
Sure.
I mean, delivering medicine is really important. Delivering water is really important. All these things are really important, but the reality is that I would argue Bitcoin is, even if it's not as immediate an importance over the long-term horizon, it's extremely important. Because if we don't have that, the most devastating and terrifying wars and famines and revolutions are ahead of us.
Yeah.
And those will have death counts far higher than anything else.
And even, we've thought about this, we've talked about this. There's well-meaning Christians who want to reflexively minimize the importance and the effect that money has. Because they're like, hey, the most important thing is preaching the gospel. The most important thing is teaching. Yes, and that is true. But the way what that fails to recognize is the way that the gospel goes out. The gospel the gospel is preached by people who have bodies, who move across bodies of water or across land. And that movement requires energy and resources that are purchased with money.
Sure.
And so there's people who want to separate and they're correct to do so to a certain extent, but they're failing to recognize the real way, like the way in which the world actually works, in which money plays a huge and very important and undeniable role.
Well,
and so this is where something like Bitcoin is incredibly practical in the pursuit of being able to do the more important thing, the eternally important thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. I frankly think money is really taboo. And I think for that reason, people overlook it. I mean, it's very easy. You know, if I was sitting here saying, I've gone to all these countries and I've delivered medicine to a bunch of kids. I mean, that's a secular thing. You know, I'm aiding in people's ability to live longer, more prosperous lives by giving them medicine or vaccines or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that is easy for us to wrap our heads around.
Sure.
You could say the same thing about education. You could say the same thing about clean water. You could say the same thing about food. But you say that about money and it's like, it's a little weird.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. Like, okay, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, it's But it's just as important, even though it's more abstract.
Yeah.
Money is the abstraction we use to acquire and communicate value of all the other things that are not abstract. Yeah. You know, you price the medicine in terms of money, you price the food in terms of money, you price the water in terms of money.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's why I say it's the biggest humanitarian effort, because if you can control and distort the money, you can control and distort everything else. If you give me the power to control the world's money, I can control who gets medicine or not. I can control who gets food or not.
So that's
why I say that's important, not because like, oh, Bitcoin's the most important so that, you know, I can get rich or we all can, you know, be wealthy or whatever. I say it because, again, just as we've said both times before, it's an abstract concept that has real world consequences.
Yeah.
And so, you know, money's a thing we use to price in everything else. And so if I can control the pricing mechanism, I can control the price of everything, and I can, you know, distort numerous things in the world. And so I think if you want to bring more medicine to more kids, if you want college to become more affordable, if you want the housing crisis to be alleviated and eventually resolved, if you want more people in the developing world to have food, if you want more people to have property rights and escape and be refugees and be under tyranny, if you want to lower the probability of war, if you want to lower the probability of people and politicians taking advantage of others. I mean, all these things, again, they all come down to money. And money's not the only factor, but it is the only factor that influences all these things.
And having conversations with people about this issue, I think one of the reasons why there's the tendency to reflexively minimize the importance and the role that money plays, there's a tendency to do so because people don't understand what money is and the function that it's supposed to serve and the function that it does serve.
Yeah. Right? I mean, again, that's the printing press. I mean, you know, we could be sitting here 500 years ago in that brewery instead of here on this podcast, and you know, a listener or a in-person listener in the brewery could say, why are you so passionate about this printing press thing? It's like the gospel is all that matters. And I'm like, yes, precisely.
Yes.
And you will print, you know, you will print 1,000 times more gospels. You will have the gospel in everyone's hands, whether they're a believer or not. You'll distribute the Bible far more widely, far faster if we do this.
Yes.
Does that mean that technology we call the printing press, should we worship that? No. Is that God? No. Is it perfect? No. But it's a technological solution to a technological problem of humans centralizing and distorting information.
Yes.
And that is a good thing in service of sharing the gospel.
Yes.
In the same way that sharing medicine or sharing food or sharing, you know, caring for the widows and the poor is in service of the gospel. And so with Bitcoin, I'd say the same thing, that for people, including myself, it's easy to write it off. But when you understand from that perspective that it's solving a problem that's so fundamental and so deep and has been lasting so long that we forget it's a problem in the first place. We just accept most of us can't read 500 years ago. And like today, we just accept that the bottom 5.5-6.5 billion people can't own a deed to their land, or they can't have a bank account. We just accept that, like, oh, that's kind of the way the world is.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, whatever. I mean, that's the thing I really want to emphasize, that ultimately the reason people like me become hyper obsessed about this thing, and the reason we talk about it all the time, is for that reason. I firmly believe this is our printing press. This is our wheel, our locomotive, our whatever. This is the thing of our time that'll be looked back upon. You know, artificial intelligence, all other tech trends, you know, I've looked at all of them. This is orders of magnitude more important.
Sure.
In terms of benefiting human life, this is far more important than AI. And like, AI is a really big deal. And in, you know, energy, you know, clean energy, you know, all those are all big deals. But again, unless we can find a way to distribute money, distribute information equally and well and morally, then all that innovation, all that AI, all that energy of the future will then be distorted to destroy other people.
And I think it's at this point, maybe we can get into, so like these are the human related reasons why this matters. And so everything, I mean, the scriptures lay out that like everything matters for one of two reasons, how it affects God and how it affects people. You know, Jesus says the greatest commandment, the thing that is what it means to be human, is to love God and to love your neighbor.
Yeah.
So what we just got done talking about is a whole bunch of reasons and ways in which money affects your ability to love your neighbor in very practical ways.
Yeah.
the structure that the money takes, though, this is maybe what I want to go into now, the structure that the money takes and the structure that the money takes has bearing on
a relationship
it's based in a vision of how the world actually works.
Yeah.
It's based in a vision. So we make money. Money can either be made and function in a way that corresponds with the way that the world works, or we can, humans, and this is what has happened throughout history, is humans can make a money in their own image that serves their own interests.
Yeah, I mean.
And that benefits them, and usually the them is the governing authorities who are at the top making this system. So maybe I'll just ask you, what are some of the ways in which, you know, either fiat currency or Bitcoin, in terms of how they work, affects loving God and affects submission or rebellion against the way that God has designed the world to work?
Yeah, this is where things get hard. It's a fine line.
Yeah.
Again, let's go to something we understand.
Yep.
And start there. Let's look at the printing press. If you're watching this and you could not read, and then I give you a book and I teach you how to read, that's going to change your brain.
Yep.
And that's going to change the way you think. That's going to change the way you think about the world. Mm-hmm. Like, that's obvious to us.
Mm-hmm.
If the person that cannot read, the person that can read, same person, same genetics, same personality, same upbringing, that medium fundamentally changes the way people perceive information. Mm-hmm. And this is one of my concerns with technology, is that it's changing so fast, we don't even realize how it's changing
what
our
it's
brains.
Doing to us.
Yeah. And you know, you can get to VR, AI, you know, augmented reality, all that stuff, which we won't get into. But that's something we can understand. I'd say it's the same thing with money. The medium of money you use changes what you do. If you have a money that's going to be worth less next year, what do? You're going to spend it more. Again, let's go all the way back to the beginning of real estate, you know, of that early part of the conversation. Like, Bible says, borrower is slave to lender, but today you're incentivized to take out debt to buy real estate. It's like, wait a second. That medium you're using has just distorted your view of money. It's just distorted your view of debt. It's just distorted your respect for
what God's word says.
You can make that argument
in the sense that we're in a system that incentivizes you to not take seriously the scriptural warnings against debt.
I think that's true. I think perhaps a softer version of that is that it changes your brain in the way that cocaine changes your brain, or the same way that a drug changes your brain. And so, yes, I think you're right. I think that's true on a spiritual level. But I think on a neurological level, I think the softer version of that, which is equally true, is that it's changing your brain and distorting it in a way that's not aligning with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, again, that's one of the main problems we have today. In the same way that the Catholic Church was giving a false gospel, in the same way, I think our current forms of money are distorting things to where they should not be. People are artificially distorted to take out debt.
Mm-hmm.
People are artificially distorted to have a shorter time preference and think in a shorter period of time.
Mm-hmm.
People are artificially distorted to engage and indulge in consumerism and pleasure and stimulation and, you know, the excitement and the next thing of the day instead of thinking long term. And I think that becomes clear. If you look at marriage rates, if you look at declining birth population, you know, immorality, you know, all the weirdness of today, I think a major part of that is that the medium that we are using to communicate value to each other all day, every day, you go to work, you price your work in terms of dollars, you save your retirement in terms of dollars, your home is in prices in terms of dollar, you know, everything in your life, you make 100 decisions a day that are constantly through that medium. And when you aggregate that out to everyone in society over many years in every facet of life to where that has to degrade at an exponential pace to prevent a credit unwind, to me, it becomes obvious. And so then, to answer your question, the reverse of that is that if we could change that medium from illiteracy, the lack of being able to read, to being able to read, to literacy, it changes people's brains. And I've seen that firsthand. Many people tell me for the first time they're thinking about a long-term future for mm-hmm. them in their career, mm-hmm. or they're thinking for the first time, you know, I do want a family. I don't want to be single my whole life. And it's fine if you're single life, but you know, like people for the first time are like, oh, well, I was just indulging in stupid things. And now I want to get married and I want to like build something that lasts because now it's truly amazing. In the same way that exercise changes your brain, in the same way that a healthy body via medicine and mm-hmm. healthy activities changes your brain, in the same way that reading and the media you consume changes your brain, I would argue that the written and unwritten rules and incentives of the money that you use to price everything in every day, that has a profound impact. And so I would make that very clear. There are some people that over-idolize Bitcoin. I think, you know, you mentioned how we can kind of seem like a cult or religion. Like, I do want to make that clear, that there are people that attribute too much over-spiritualization to Bitcoin, definitely. At the end of the day, it's just a tool. And like every other tool we've ever used, it influences our behavior and it changes our behavior. And I just think ultimately that, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think one of the things that I think about, again, the effect that this, so why should Christians care about this? This is part of the reason this podcast exists is, you know, we think that Bitcoin matters for lots of reasons. And there's, again, many of them are reasons, and there'll be many podcast episodes where we talk about practical ways in which, you know, Bitcoin changes the incentives of things like food production or health or education or all these things. But one of the ways in which money also distorts and changes and affects how we see the world is that it affects how we think about ourselves.
Yes.
And it affects how we think about our own identity. And so the way that happens is, for instance, with the creation of the Federal Reserve, people go from being stewards of value and stewards of resources and stewards of processes that God has created to govern the world to, we are now creators of value. We are creators of processes that, you know, are working towards certain ends. And so this is a huge issue of, in, you know, God creates a world where he puts people in charge of it and he calls them to be stewards. And we're going to give an account for how we submit ourselves to the way that God has created the world, both physically, you know, processionally in terms of, you know, God has created relationships to flourish in a certain context. He's created all these different things to flourish. And we're going to give account for how well and how accurately and how faithfully we said to God with our mouths and with our actions, may your kingdom come, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And the constant temptation for people since the very beginning, in many ways, including up through today in monetary creation, is to say with the way that we structure our money, to create it in such a way that it says, let my kingdom come. It's a way for humanity to say, let our kingdom come, let our will be done on earth as in heaven as it is here in our hearts and minds.
Yeah, let me put it in a slightly different way. I like what you said. The way I would put it is that money is energy. Money is what we use to price in all energy and all things we value. And if a human being can print money, then that human being and everyone that follows the rules of that human being
is functionally saying, acting like this person can create this energy out of.
Yeah, this person is a monetary god.
Yeah.
This person can create U.S. dollars.
Yes.
And go to a foreign nation and say, I want your oil.
Yeah.
And if you don't give us your oil, we will use a barrel of a gun to enforce this dollar. Yeah. Or I want your labor cheaper. I want this cheaper. I want that. If you can print money, you can print energy. And because that's out of line with reality, you have to use force to enforce the lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that simple. And so Bitcoin is that there's this. No human can control it. No human can make or destroy. And I mean, this is why, you know, people don't realize this, but technologists and finance people, they don't understand Bitcoin very well. Engineers understand Bitcoin. We're here in Colorado at this conference.
Yeah.
I get off the plane. First person I meet is an aerospace engineer. Second person I meet is a chemical engineer. Third person I meet is an engineer. Okay. Yeah. There's only 30 people at this group. Like the vast majority of the people here have an engineering background.
Yeah.
Because finance people don't get it, and technologists don't get it.
It's more challenging. There's more.
It's significantly more challenging because, again, the medium you use to think, the line of thinking you have changes your thinking. And the engineers happen to be the people to understand this They understand energy, law of conservation energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed, which in line with God, there is no spiritual authority outside of God. No one can create energy. And so creating money is this perversion of mechanics and engineering, which is why engineers really get the, and it's this indirect, abstract way of distorting the truth of God that no human is moral enough to declare what is valuable to everyone else in the world, besides Jesus. And and no human has
good to clarify the exception.
Well, yeah, obviously, you know. Well, really, it's the case. Like, what's the most effective government? What's the most moral government? The most moral government
benevolent dictatorship.
Benevolent dictatorship. Now, do I think that's true in this world? No, absolutely not. Why? Because there's no human that is worthy of being developed. It's the same thing with money.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. So yeah, I think you're spot on. And you know, people, you know, I try not to put people down too much if they don't. You know, there are many Christians I know that respectfully disagree with me and don't have this passion for Bitcoin. I get that. That's fine. You know, I mean, Bitcoiners can be missionaries in their own ways, but for me, I really thrive on long-term thinking and I really thrive on efficiency. And I don't know of a single technology on the planet that reduces the probability of unnecessary human suffering and increases the probability simultaneously for human flourishing and prosperity, both in the present and the future, than Bitcoin. More than any medicine, more than any agricultural innovations going on, again, AI, everything else. I think this Bitcoin thing is far more important. And you could say I'm biased for saying that. I am, sure. But I really believe that. You can be a missionary anywhere in the world. We do need missionaries anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But in whatever your missionary work is and whatever your evangelism is, presenting the gospel in the written word is probably more efficient than saying it audibly.
Yeah.
And likewise, using a form of money that doesn't hurt, steal, and destroy from the person you're trying to serve is probably going to be more efficient than trying to work through a medium that is doing that.
Yeah, I think another thing that comes into play here is the method of communication. So the more that you, money affects the method of communication. So the more that you, when you bring in a money that can be created by people, a small group of people out of thin air, you increase the incentive for that small group of people to wield that tool as a cudgel against the poor and the weak, and to use this tool that is, I mean, money is designed to be a tool that helps people flourish. It helps them to, you know, enable efficient communication of resources, you know, the distribution of resources. It now turns this tool into a weapon. And so this is something that is completely, that ends up making the priorities that the scriptures lay out for humans to pursue. It makes those things more difficult to pursue.
Yeah.
And it attacks, if not in reality, it attacks the dignity of the fact that every person is made in the image and likeness of God. And so functionally, when you have a money that is created by people that favors, you know, certain groups of people over others, you're functionally saying there are people who are much more, you create there's multiple stratas of people. There's people who are really powerful and really important who are more in a kind of real sense, they're more like God. And then you have these people who are poor and weak and their dignity and their work and their time and their labor is not as worthy of, it's not as valuable as these other ones.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's no longer most important if you're human or not. It's most important how close are you to the money printer. What we do. And this is why it's hard for Americans and Europeans to understand Bitcoin. And this is something that should be said too. Like, what we're saying is, again, very abstract. You know, this is just a podcast, but like, this is real data. 7 of the 10 fastest adopting nations in the world are developing nations.
7 of the 8 fastest Bitcoin adoption.
7 of the 10... of the 10 fastest nations that are adopting Bitcoin the fastest, 7 of them are developing nations. And the 3 exceptions are Germany, the Netherlands, and the Swiss. Okay. And that's for separate reasons. You know, Germany had their own hyperinflationary event. The Dutch Empire, after 300 years, had their debt wiped in an afternoon a few hundred years ago. And my point being that yeah, well, ultimately what's most important is that human beings are treated like human beings. And so I think this does that.
Yeah. By creating a money that doesn't play favorites.
Yeah.
Has a set of rules, the same set of rules for rich, poor, whatever, old, young, whatever, treats everybody the same.
Yeah.
It's a more humanizing tool.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
As we come to a close, Luke, is there anything else that you want to communicate to people, or is there anything else that you want to add based on what we talked about?
Yeah. I think it's important to remember that this is just a piece of technology. Mm-hmm. I'm very optimistic on this piece of technology. There's a chance I'm wrong mm-hmm. about this piece of technology, but I don't think I am. Mm-hmm. I'm really obsessed over what if I am. And in many ways, I hope I am, because I think war and conflict is probably very probable. Because what happens when there's no longer money to communicate value with each other? It's like things break down. Mm-hmm. Inherently, they break down. You know, if we think of a deer, you know, a buck with his antlers.
No.
Two bucks settle energy disputes. Who owns the territory? No, really?
Yeah, seriously. 100%, yeah.
When two male bucks, they're both in their prime health, are like, I want the mates and I want the land, they settle that via their antlers. They get in this conflict. And the design of antlers is that they don't kill each other, ideally, mm-hmm. they don't kill each mm-hmm. other. Mm-hmm. And money is that kind of antlers for us. Mm-hmm. And if we get rid of that, if that gets destroyed, then the only way to settle that dispute is for the last one standing, you know? Mm-hmm. And so is Bitcoin a certainty? No, I don't think it is. But I think it's very probable that Bitcoin is what we think it is, and it's extremely important. And I think if it isn't what we think it is, that it's very depressing, because mm-hmm. then it's almost certain that our current form of antlers will continue to degrade in the future, and then we'll just have to settle everything through guns instead of currency. We are already in a currency war.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that's important is, I mean, the reason why you can say that, and the reason why we can say that with a good degree of certainty, is that this isn't the first rodeo. Like, this has happened numerous times throughout history, yeah. and this is how empires come to an end, is by, you know, their currencies degrade. They take shortcuts, and then it brings these things about. So, and this is the incredible thing, is that, and this is not designed to be some fatalistic thing at all, because if Bitcoin disappeared tomorrow, and if, you know, these things, money breaks down, and yeah. so it'll get bad, but, you know, but God.
Yeah, yeah, God is sovereign.
Yeah.
And the world will transpire exactly as,
sure.
as it is supposed to. I've got confidence sure. in that. Whether that's good or bad, it's the reality.
Yeah.
But
the fact that we exist in a world where there's a money that does not prey upon the weak and the poor.
We can do everything in our power to increase the probability of a better future, even if we know that better future will never be perfect.
Yeah. And this is what we do. Like, this is what, I mean, there's people who look at Christians and are like, oh, look at you, you know, living in a way that is just, you know, that's not how the world is. You know, you're loving your enemy. That's not sustainable. All these kind of things. We've, you know, God's, people have been telling Christians, and the people have been telling the people of God for a very long time that obeying God and trusting him and living in accord with his ways and his design and all these things, his revealed good design, won't work. And they've been being proven wrong for a very long time. And so,
yeah.
you know, here we are, we have this tool, we're going to use that tool in its context while we do the things that God has given us to do.
Yeah.
And there's many things which Bitcoin doesn't touch. And so we're not going to bring it into there.
Sure. Yeah. Humans will remain sinful no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we look at the first half of the 20th century, a lot of people died, and for no logical reason. Mm-hmm. And we've been very, very absurdly fortunate the last 80 years mm-hmm. that we've had a new form of money. You know, look at the end of the 1800s, the decline of the British pound, mm-hmm. and then rise of the American dollar, in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And we're very fortunate that we've lived in this height of American dominance, America's currency dominance, mm-hmm. but things are starting to unravel, and the brutal truth that people don't want to, and ultimately this is why most people don't want to learn about Bitcoin. They don't want to admit that there's a problem, that things are broken, and that they've been a part of that, and they've been duped, essentially, mm-hmm. for most of life. But most people don't want to admit that. I had to admit
but
that.
But do you think that's the reason why most people don't get into Bitcoin, like, or don't take the time to do it?
I think there are many reasons, but I think that's a major reason. Like yeah. When you've met as many people as I have, and you've talked to as many people as I have, and you have about Bitcoin, I think it becomes abundantly clear that most people don't want to admit we need a money without human control, because we want to believe the lie that if just we were in charge of the money, then everything would be fine. Very few people want to admit that.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there's a number of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think another thing too, is that one of the ways there's people who they come to change their mind, and they come to understand the importance and the role that money plays in life through conversations, and hopefully that will be the fruit of this conversation. But in many more cases, the way that people wake up to and are willing to face the difficult realities of life is through pain.
Yeah.
And so I think that, for instance, there's a lot of people using Bitcoin in Venezuela, and the reason why they're doing so is not because they were just going about their lives and they just happened across it and they started to, you know, think, oh man, this really makes a lot of sense. They came upon it and began to use it out of necessity.
Yeah. Again, 7 of the 10 fast adopting nations are developing nations. Okay. Yeah. People living on $3,000 a year with inflation twice as high as your inflation are adopting Bitcoin faster than you are. And you're too scared because you're in your Western privilege and your American conveniences, and you don't understand how essential this is, and you don't understand that things are going to get worse. People that are having more of that pain, literally on a per capita basis, are adopting it faster than us. I mean, that really goes to show how directly this is alleviating pain. Mm-hmm. The people in positions with far more financial and economic pain than we are, mm-hmm. they don't have to have as many podcasts as us Americans are, you know, which is just the truth. Like, they get it.
Yeah.
You know, like here, if I say the American government's going to destroy our currency, mm-hmm. like, people think I'm a conspiracy theorist. if you're in Argentina, you've lived through that four times.
Yeah. Including like right now,
including right now. I mean, if you lived in another country, you're experiencing that, you know, Sri Lanka, Lebanon, I mean, Turkey, most people won't understand Zimbabwe. This until they've lived through it, which is just, you know, it's just reality. But that doesn't change the fact that I am to do my best to prevent that.
Yeah. And live in a way that, you know, live and use the tools that you have available to you to pursue the glory of God and the good of your neighbor.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that I'm doing things the best and right way possible. I think so.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, Luke.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure. I hope people keep learning about Bitcoin, learning about God, and pursuing truth. Ultimately, that's what's most important. Mm-hmm. And I don't know a lot, but I am pretty confident on this. So we'll see.
Where can people find you, find out more information, follow you on the internet?
Yeah, I have Twitter or X, whatever you call it, and YouTube under my name, Luke Broyles, Broyles. I also work for the Bitcoin Advisor, which is an Australian company mm-hmm. that helps people buy, store, and custody their Bitcoin for them and for future generations. Very, very low time preference. Mm-hmm. So I work there. People can talk to me there. They can just fill out a form and then they can book a consultation mm-hmm. with me. Or my social media, like I said, YouTube and Facebook. I've got a lot of projects I'm very excited about sharing with people. So, I really appreciate the time and the invite. Thank you.
Yep. We'll talk soon.